Where are you going?
No stick. Okay. This evening, the talk, the Dhamma discourse I'm going to read out is the Angulimala Sutta on this character who is well known in this area. I'm sure if there was ever any movies made about the Buddha, because Hollywood or Bollywood always likes a bit of blood and guts, Angulimala would make an excellent subject for a movie. So here we go. There's a bit of background first of all. From the commentary, the name Angulimala is an epithet meaning garland of fingers. Garland is mala. That's the garlands which you have, the mala beads. Anguli is finger. And that's actually where we get the English word inch, which is the finger width. Comes from the same root, anguli, inch. And he was the son of the Brahmin Bhagawa, not the Bhagawan like in the Lord, it's the double G, a chaplain to King Prasenadi of Kosala. So he actually came from this area. His given name, strangely enough, was Ahimsaka, meaning harmless one. And he studied at Takasila, modern day Taxila in the north of Pakistan, which was a famous university, even before Nalanda. So Nalanda wasn't the first university. If there's any first university, it would be up in Taxila, where he became his teacher's favorite. His fellow students became jealous of him and told the teacher that Ahimsaka had committed adultery with his wife. And the teacher, intent on bringing Ahimsaka to ruin, commanded him to bring him 1,000 human right-hand fingers as the teacher's fee. In other words, once you studied under a teacher, you had to give him something back. And this is what he demanded. And literally, Ahimsaka didn't have much choice. So Ahimsaka lived in the Jalini forest. He did not live in that little tunnel in the stupa, which we went to see in the first place. He lived in the Jalini forest, not far from here, attacking travelers, and he would cut off a finger of each and wear them as a garland around his neck. At the time this sutta opens, he had 999 fingers. He was just one short. And he had made the determination to kill the next person to come along. And the next person who was coming along was his mother. And the Buddha saw that Angulimala's mother was on her way to visit him, and aware that Angulimala had the supporting conditions for full enlightenment, he intercepted him shortly before his mother was due to arrive. And so that's the background to the story. Now we get to the story itself. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anatta Pindika's Park, where you just spent today. Now, on that occasion, there was a bandit in the realm of King Prasenadi of Kosala, named Angulimala, who was murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, merciless to living beings. Villages, towns and districts were laid waste by him. He was constantly murdering people, and he wore their fingers as a garland. Then, when it was morning, the Blessed One, dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Sarvati for alms food. When he had wandered for alms in Sarvati and had returned from his alms round, after his meal, he set his resting place in order, and taking his bowl and outer robe, set out on the road leading towards Angulimala. Cowherds, shepherds and ploughmen passing by saw the Blessed One walking along the road leading towards Angulimala, and they told him, "Do not take this road, recluse. On this road is a bandit, Angulimala, who is murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, merciless to living beings. Villages, towns and districts have all been laid waste by him. He is constantly murdering people, and he wears their fingers as a garland. Men have come along this road in groups of 10, 20, 30, and even 40 strong. But still they have fallen in to the murderous hands of Angulimala. When this was said, the Blessed One went on in silence. For the second time, for the third time, the cowherds, shepherds and ploughmen told this to the Blessed One. But still the Blessed One continued in silence. Short time later, the bandit Angulimala saw the Buddha coming in the distance. When he saw him, Angulimala thought, "It is wonderful, it is marvelous. Men have come along this road in groups of 10, 20, 30 and even 40. They have still fallen into my hands. And now this recluse comes alone, unaccompanied, as if driven by karma. Why shouldn't I take this recluse's life?" Angulimala then took up his sword and his shield, buckled on his bow and quiver, and followed close behind the Buddha. Then the Buddha performed such a feat of supernormal power that the bandit Angulimala, though running as fast as he could not catch up with the Buddha, who was only walking at his normal pace. Then the bandit Angulimala thought, "It is wonderful, it is marvelous. Formerly I could catch up even with a swift elephant and seize it. I could catch up even with a swift horse and seize it. I could even catch up with a swift chariot and seize it. You could probably even catch our bus." But now, though I'm walking as fast as I can, I cannot catch up with this recluse who is walking at his normal pace. He stopped and called out to the Blessed One, "Stop, recluse! Stop, recluse!" And the Buddha said, "I have stopped, Angulimala. You stop too." Then the bandit Angulimala thought, "These recluses, sons of the Sakyans," obviously didn't realize it was the Buddha. Sons of the Sakyans were just the name for Buddhist monks. So he knew what Buddhist monks were, but he didn't know this was the Buddhist monk, the Buddha himself. "These recluses, sons of the Sakyans, always speak the truth. They always tell the truth. But though this recluse is still walking, he says I have stopped. And he tells me, Angulimala, you stop too. Suppose I question this recluse." Then the bandit Angulimala addressed the Blessed One in verse thus. This is where it gets a little unbelievable, because in such a situation you would start doing extemporaneous poetry. But nevertheless, here we get in poetry. "While you are walking, recluse, you tell me you have stopped. But now when I have stopped, you say I have not stopped. I ask you now, O recluse, about the meaning. How is it that you have stopped while you're still walking, and I have not stopped when I'm standing still?" And the Buddha replies, "Angulimala, I have stopped forever. I abstain from violence towards living beings, for you have no restraint towards things alive. That is why I have stopped, and you have not." And obviously, at this point, Angulimala realized that someone had come who he never expected. The commentary says that at that point Angulimala had just realized the monk before him was no ordinary monk, but was the Buddha himself, and that he had come to the forest on purpose for meeting Angulimala. So he said to the Buddha, now recognizing, "Oh, at long last this recluse, a venerated sage, has come to this great forest for my sake. Having heard your stanza teaching me the Dhamma, I will indeed renounce forever." Remember, he was a very faithful young man. He was doing this because he had to, because his teacher told him, and he believed that he should follow the advice of his teacher. And so now he got a better teacher. He was willing to follow the Buddha's advice. So saying, the bandit took his sword and weapons and flung them in a pit. And then the bandit worshipped the Sublime One's feet And then and there he asked for the going forth as a novice monk. And the enlightened one, the sage of great compassion, the teacher of the world with all its gods, addressed him with these words, Ehi Bhikkhu, come Bhikkhu. And that was how he became a Bhikkhu, a monk. That was the special way the Buddha would ordain people, not with any great ceremony. He would just look at them and say, come monk, Ehi Bhikkhu. And that was the original ordination ceremony. Hardly much ceremony at all. Just the word of the Buddha, and you were a monk straight away. Then the Blessed One set out to wander back to Sarvati with Angulimala as his attendant. Wandering by stages, he eventually arrived in Sarvati, and there he lived at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove and Natapindika's Park. So you see, if it took some days to wander back with Angulimala as his attendant, it couldn't have been that close to Sarvati, probably maybe 40, 50, 60, 80 kilometers away. So when I said the other day on the bus number 2, I think it was, that where did Angulimala live? And I said, probably around here somewhere, look out for robbers. That's probably quite true. So the Blessed One with Angulimala as his attendant arrived back at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove and Natapindika's Park. Now on that occasion, great crowds of people were gathering at the gates of King Pasenadi's inner palace, very loud and noisy, crying, Sire, Sire, the bandit Angulimala is in your realm. He is murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, and merciless to all living beings. Villages, towns, and districts have been laid waste by him. He is constantly murdering people, and he wears their fingers as a garland. The king must put him down. So it was a protest. Then in the middle of the day, King Pasenadi of Kosala drove out of Sarvati with a cavalry of 500 men and set out for the park. He drove thus as far as the road was passable for carriages, and then he dismounted from his chariot and went forward on foot to see the Blessed One. After paying homage to the Blessed One, he sat down at one side. And the Buddha said to him, What is it, great king? Is King Bimbisara of Magadha attacking you? Or is it the Lichavis of Visali or other hostile kings? Remember, those were the two other great kingdoms at the time. Well, one was the Republic, the Kingdom of Magadha, King Bimbisara. The other one, the Lichavis, the Republic of Visali, which went to both places. And it seems in those days they're always attacking each other, which is what kings did. Venerable sir, King Sena Bimbisara of Magadha is not attacking me, nor are the Lichavis of Visali, nor are other hostile kings, but there is a bandit in my realm named Angulimala, who is murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, and merciless to living beings. Villages, towns, and districts have been laid waste by him. He is constantly murdering people, and he wears their fingers as a garland. I shall never be able to put him down, venerable sir. Great king, said the Buddha, just suppose you were to see that Angulimala had shaved off his hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and gone forth from the home life into homelessness. Suppose that he was now abstaining from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, from forced speech. He was refraining from eating at night, eating only one part of the day. He was celibate, virtuous, of good character. Suppose he was a monk. If you were to see him thus, how would you treat him? Just suppose. Venerable sir, we would pay homage to him, or rise up for him, or invite him to be seated, or we would invite him to accept robes, alms food, a resting place, or medicinal requisites. Or we would arrange for him lawful guarding, defense, and protection. Because that's actually the duty of a king. That's actually in the Dharma. This is what kings should do, if they're Buddhist kings, to the Sangha, to look after them, invite them, to make sure that they're well guarded and protected. But the King Pasenadi says, But, venerable sir, he's such an immoral man, one of evil character. How could he ever have such virtue and restraint? Now, on that occasion, the venerable, this is not Angulimala, the venerable Angulimala was sitting not far from the Blessed One. Then the Blessed One extended his right arm and said to the king, Prasenadi of Kosala, Great king, this is Angulimala. Then King Prasenadi was frightened, alarmed, and terrified. Knowing this, the Blessed One told him, Do not be afraid, great king. Do not be afraid. There is nothing for you to fear from him. And then because of the Buddha's kind words, the king's fear, alarm, and terror subsided. He went over to the Venerable Angulimala and said, Venerable sir, is the noble lord really Angulimala? Yes, great king, said Angulimala. Venerable sir, of what family is the noble one's father? Of what family is his mother? My father is a Gagga, great king. My mother is a Mantani. Let the noble lord Gagga Mantani Puta rest consent. I shall provide robes, arms, food, resting place, and medicinal requisites for the noble lord Gagga Mantani Puta. Now at that time, the Venerable Angulimala was a forest dweller, an alms food eater, a refuse rag wearer, and restricted himself to three robes. So he replied, Enough, great king, my triple robe is complete. Those are four of what became known as the Dutanga rules, to live in the forest. So it's actually interesting there, he was in the Sarvati with the Buddha. That doesn't really count as a forest dwelling, he must have actually spent time outside there. A refuse rag wearer is where you get your robes from pieces of cloth which you pick up as a refuse, and you stir them all together and dye them, making them your robe, a robe of rags. And he only had three robes, he would never have anything extra, and he would eat only what he got on alms food in the city. He would not accept any meals brought to him or go to house dines and things like that. So he would not accept anything from the king. And then the king returned to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down on one side and said, It's so wonderful, Venerable Sir, it's marvellous how the Blessed One tames the untamed, brings peace to the unpeaceful, and leads to Nibbana those who have not attained Nibbana. Venerable Sir, we ourselves, with all our army, could not tame Angulimala with force and weapons. Yet the Blessed One has tamed him without any force, without any weapons. And now, Venerable Sir, we depart. We are busy. We are a king. We have much to do. Now is the time, great king, to do as you think fit. Then King Prasenadi of Kosala rose from his seat, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right side is how we do the circumambulation. And so this is the first half of the story here, just how the Buddha subdued this fierce murderer just with the Dhamma. And once he was a monk, even though he committed many crimes, you know, the king would not arrest him or do anything to him. Now he was a monk, he was a monk. You see, there's never any idea of revenge in Buddhism. If you become a monk, that's fine, you've been rehabilitated. And so just to subdue, to tame him, the king's job had been done. Whatever Angulimala, bad karma had done, karma would look after that, which happened soon afterwards. And this is very much a true story, because this is one of the most famous legends of Buddhism, which happened here. There's many murals, many paintings, many carvings of Angulimala. So it's almost certain this actually happened. The Buddha subdued this murderer just with his kindness. Then when it was morning, the Venerable Angulimala, dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Sarvati for alms. And he was wandering for alms from house to house in Sarvati. He saw a certain woman giving birth, a breech birth. When he saw this, he thought, How beings are afflicted, indeed, how beings are afflicted. When he had wandered for alms in Sarvati and returned from his alms round, after his meal, he went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down on one side and said, Venerable Sir, just now, when I was going for alms in Sarvati, I saw a certain woman who was giving a breech birth in a lot of pain. Then I saw that, and when I saw that, I thought, How beings are afflicted, how beings are afflicted. And the Buddha replied, In that case, Angulimala, go back into Sarvati and say to that woman, Sister, since I was born, I do not recall that I have ever intentionally deprived a living being of life. By the power of this truth, may you be well, and may your infant be well. repeat that. Sister, since I was born, I do not recall that I have ever intentionally deprived a living being of life. By this power of this truth, may you be well and may your infant be well. And Anguli Mata said, Venerable Sir, wouldn't I be telling a deliberate lie? For I have intentionally deprived many living beings of life. Then Anguli Mata, go into Sawati and say that to that woman, Sister, since I was born with the noble birth, as an Aryan, as a noble one, since I was born with the noble birth, I do not recall that I have ever intentionally deprived a living being of life. By this truth, may you be well and may your infant be well. Yes, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Anguli Mata replied. And having gone into Sawati, he chanted to that woman, Sister, since I was born with a noble birth, I do not recall that I have ever intentionally deprived a living being of life. By this truth, may you and your infant be well. And at those words, the woman gave birth to a healthy baby, and both were well. And that, to this day, is called the Anguli Mata protection, which monks actually chant, sometimes not realizing the origin of that. It has the power if it's actually chanted by someone who has a noble birth. Otherwise, the monk chanting it is not really telling the truth. But here, because of the power of Anguli Mata's change from being a murderer to being a noble birth when it didn't harm anybody, you can see the power of such aspiration would have enormous effect. And so it did. And this time it showed that Anguli Mata was a noble one, but he wasn't yet an arahat. He was obviously either a stream winner, once returner, or non-returner, because the next paragraph says, Before long, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the Venerable Anguli Mata, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge in this very life, entered upon and abided in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which people rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. He directly knew birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. And the Venerable Anguli Mata became one of the arahats, the standard description of the enlightenment. And it says, obviously he was a stream winner before because he said he was born in a noble birth. And here I always stress that dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute. This is what one needs to do to become an arahat. Alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute. And so the Venerable Anguli Mata became one of the arahats. Then when it was morning, the Venerable Anguli Mata, dressed, taking his bowl and outer robe, went to Sawati for alms. Now on that occasion, someone threw a clod of earth and hit the Venerable Anguli Mata's body. Someone else threw a stick and hit his body. Someone else threw a potsherd and hit his body. This was the result of the karma. Even though he was an arahat, he still had to suffer some of the result of the karma of killing 999 people. And then with blood running from his cut head, with his bowl broken, he used to have clay bowls, so cut head, bowl broken, with the outer robe torn, in other words, he really got a pounding. The Venerable Anguli Mata went to the Blessed One. The Blessed One saw him come in the distance and told him, Bear it, Anguli Mata, bear it, Brahmin. You are experiencing in this very life the results of the deeds, because of which you might have been tortured in hell for many years, for many hundreds of years, for many thousands of years. Then, while the Venerable Anguli Mata was alone in retreat, experiencing the bliss of deliverance, he uttered this exclamation, Who once did live in negligence, and then is negligent no more. He illuminates the world like the moon freed from a cloud. Which is Dhammapada, verse 172. It seems to be first spoken by Anguli Mata. Who once did live in negligence, and then is negligent no more. They illuminate the world like the moon freed from a cloud. Who checks the evil deeds he did, by doing wholesome deeds instead. He illuminates the world like the moon from a freed from a cloud. Dhammapada, verse 173. The youthful bhikkhu who devotes his efforts to the Buddha's teachings, he illuminates the world like the moon freed from a cloud. This is the one who goes forth in young age to follow the Buddha's teaching. He illuminates the world like the moon feed from a cloud. And Gaudiya continues, let my enemies hear discourse of the Dhamma. Let them be devoted to the Buddha's teachings. Let my enemies wait on those good people who lead others to accept the Dhamma. Let my enemies give ear from time to time and hear the Dhamma of those who preach forbearance, of those who speak as well in praise of kindness, and let them follow up that Dhamma with kind deeds. To listen first of all, and then to act with kind deeds. For surely, then, they would not wish to harm me, nor would they think of harming other beings. So those who would protect all, frail or strong, let them attain the all-surpassing peace. Now we've got another famous Dhammapada quote. Conduit makers, these are irrigators, guide the water. Fletchers who make arrows straighten out the arrow shaft. Carpenters straighten out the timber. And wise men seek to tame themselves. There are some that tame with beatings, some with goads and some with whips. But I was tamed by such alone, who has no rod nor any weapon, the Buddha. Harmless Ahimsaka is the name I bear, though I was very dangerous in the past. The name I bear today is true, for now I hurt no living being at all. And though I once lived as a bandit with the name of Finger Garland Angulimala, one whom the great flood of craving swept along, I went for refuge to the Buddha. And though I once was bloody-handed with the name of Finger Garland, see the refuge I have found. The bond of being has now been cut. While I did many deeds that lead to rebirth in the evil realms, yet the result has reached me now, and so I eat free from debt. There are fools and who have no sense, who give themselves to negligence, but those of wisdom guard diligence and treat it as their greatest good. Looking at diligence as your greatest treasure. Do not give way to negligence, nor seek delight in sensual pleasures, but meditate with diligence so as to reach the perfect bliss. So welcome to that choice of mine, and let it stand. It was not ill-made. Of all the Dhammas known to men, I have come to the very best. So welcome to that choice of mine, and let it stand. It was not ill-made. I have attained the Tevijja, the triple knowledge, and done all that the Buddhas teach me to do. And those are the verses of Angulimala, the Arahat, fully enlightened. It says in here the way this original sutta was, that even though that he was attacked and beaten, he didn't die from those, but died much later as an arahant, but still had to bear some of the fruit of that bad karma. But it didn't matter because he was now fully enlightened. Now it's a great story, a very traditional story in Buddhism, because it shows that even serial killers can actually go forth as monks and become fully enlightened. Because these days people say, oh, I haven't got what it takes to become enlightened. Maybe other people can become enlightened, but not me. If a serial killer can become enlightened, can't you? Are you that bad? Have you got that bad karma? People say, oh, I haven't got enough good karma to become enlightened. Angulimala, even though it's a serial killer, had enough good karma to get enlightened. So it just actually shows what is actually possible. So, that was the story of Angulimala, with his verses. And that happened right here in Sawati and the environments. So if while you are around here or in Benares tomorrow, if some robber comes up to you or brigand and they start running after you with a sword or whatever, just say stop. Any questions on that sutta? Yes. How did he die? Actually, it doesn't say how he died in that sutta. I know because it does mention that he was attacked, that things got thrown at him. It's not sure whether that was actually just by accident or throwing at something else, but because of its karma, it hit him. Or he was deliberately attacked. To me, it sounds that he would not be deliberately attacked simply because he was a monk and this was the Buddha's area, and that people, out of reverence, they would leave him alone. And if they did attack him on purpose, they would get into big trouble with the king personality, because it was the king's job to protect the monks, no matter who they were. Because of that, I cannot see that the traditional idea he was deliberately attacked by people seeking revenge would have actually held much water. So I think he probably was by accident sometimes, some of these things, maybe something being thrown at a crow or something, and it hit him instead. It was more likely. So he still had to receive the fruit of his, some of the fruit of his bad karma, but not that much. This is a story about how we overcome bad karma. You can't get rid of the bad karma, but you can dilute it. A very famous simile of, you have a spoonful of salt in a cup of water, the whole thing is salty. A spoonful of salt in a whole swimming pool of water, can hardly taste it. So you can't get rid of the bad karma there represented by the spoonful of salt, but you can dilute it with huge amounts of good karma. And of course, becoming enlightened was one of the biggest huge amounts of good karma you can possibly do. Yes, someone else? You can't wipe it out, you dilute it. So you said that he would have to go usually for thousands of years in some sort of hell realm. But because of his enlightenment, you only just, you know, a little bit of a cut here, a bruise there, not much.
Was it the enlightenment per se, or the taking the changes?
Both of them. They say that taking refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha is such great good karma. It outweighs like billions of dollars of donations. Keeping the five precepts is much, much, much stronger good karma than taking refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Meditating, getting liberation of mind, is even greater karma still.
Bad guys.
I suppose so, yeah. They make some good karma, so it dilutes the effects of their bad karma. Certainly does. Yeah? Talk, yeah? Yes, certainly. Okay, I never said this, the Buddha said it. I was just reading what the Buddha said. The Buddha said the Anapanasati fulfills the four stages of foundations of mindfulness, the four Satipatthana. And the first four of the 16 stages fulfills the contemplation of the body. The next four stages, 5 to 8, fulfills the Vedana, contemplation. The next four stages fills the citta, contemplation, and the last four stages fulfill the Dhamma, contemplation. So the 16 stages of Anapanasati fulfill all the four Satipatthanas. I just mention that because I think in the Burmese tradition they keep on saying that vipassana equals Satipatthana, and they call their method Satipatthana meditation. But according to the sutras, what the Buddha said, the Anapanasati is Satipatthana meditation, because Anapanasati fulfills the four Satipatthanas. That's why I read it out, made a point of it. So you don't have to say only beginners do Anapanasati. Once you've done the beginning, then you can go on to the higher Vipassana. Anapanasati is a full practice. Yeah. This is an amazing thing about when you do bad things, that you can let go of them any time, no matter how massive they are. The idea of like guilt and especially like guilt, is a psychological problem, mostly for many Westerners. You do only a small thing, you can never forgive yourself. And sometimes you need to go to a therapist for years and years and years to work out your guilt trip. And many people in ancient cultures don't have such a guilt trip. I remember the Dalai Lama saying he was amazed just how, you know, Westerners in particular all into this guilt thing. You know, what they did in the past, they can never forgive themselves, let alone forgiving others. And it's from the very beginning of Buddhism, it's a very different psychology of forgiveness, not guilt, and not sort of punishing, but sort of rehabilitation. So even now, you know, in the West, when somebody does a crime, too many people just want to throw them in a jail and lock them away forever and ever and ever. It's a punishment culture, revenge culture. Not Angulimala, but Osama bin Laden blows up the Twin Towers, and Mr. Bush feels it's his duty to seek revenge. They need to be punished. They do not need to be forgiven. And the forgiveness doesn't come into it. But in Buddhism, from the very beginning, now forgiveness is there. It's encouraged. So you can even forgive that much. You can let go of that much of your past bad actions, which, you know, in the West, if you're a serial killer for 999 lives, straight away, even before they became a monk, you'd send them for counselling. You know, for, you know, because you must have terrible counselling if you've killed 999 people. It's just the same as that. When I came back from Penang, I was there for just after the tsunami. I was in Malaysia, and just coming back a few days later, there was an announcement on the plane coming back: anyone who's been to tsunami-affected areas has to go and report for counselling in the Perth airport. So I reported at the desk and say I was in Penang. I said, "Oh, do you want counselling?" I said, "Come off it, shut up." So I walked away from it. But like many people, they just think you have to have counselling. Because in Western psychology, is very, very different. We have very much a culture of guilt and punishment. At the time it would, but you were trained, or it's part of maybe the Asian culture, to let go of the past. And this is actually what a good meditator can do. They can let go of the past straight away. It doesn't matter what you've done in the past. You can actually let the whole lot go. It's able to do that. A simile which I've been given, it's like the prison of the past, the door is always open. It is a cell, but you can walk out any time you want from your past. You can let it go, if you really have the guts to do so. So it's incredible that sometimes we've done these things in the past, we feel bad about it, we just can't drop it. Why? So you can come back again? Why cultivate sila? Because after a while of letting go of the bad, it just becomes nature. You've got no bad in you. There's no reason to do those things. It's interesting that the people who don't forgive the past tend to repeat the past. Now, if you have been a murderer and you can't forgive yourself, you tend to keep murdering again. It's a part of rehabilitation, is to let go and forgive. Simply because if that's what you keep thinking about, that's what you become. That's what you become, that's what you repeat. You are the criminal, you are the murderer, you are the thief. That's who you think you are, because you can't let go of that past. So you keep on acting in the same way. But as soon as you let it go, you forgive, then there's always that freedom to change. That's one of the problems with punishing criminals. As soon as they're out of jail, they reoffend again, because they've become criminals. They've identified with that label, because that's their punishment. It's fascinating. It's a good question you asked. How on earth could that happen? Angulimala, with all of that killing, all that bad karma, and the bad mind states, which would have been there at the time of his killing, how could he just suddenly change? The point was, you can. It's possible. You can let go of the past. And sometimes you do see people like that, who have some terrible, terrible crimes they've done in the past, and something happens, they just change. And they have this moment of courage, I call it, where they can let go completely of the past and become a new person. It's said here like, you know, almost like a born again Buddhist. He's been reborn in the Aryan lineage. Since my birth is a noble lineage, I have not killed any other being. Does that make sense there? Okay, yes. It could have been, yeah. Sometimes that might have been so, that you say, was the Buddha thinking of using Angulimala as an example for others? It may have been so, I'm not sure about that, but certainly it became an example to others. And that's one of the reasons why it became such a famous story. Because it gave, as it were, hope to others that anybody can become enlightened. If Angulimala can do it, people think so can I. So what it did, it made this sort of open the doors to enlightenment to anybody. Correct, yeah. That's right. It was an extreme example. Had another extreme example you saw in the Navajetavana temple on the pictures of Patachari, who was completely out of her mind. Crazy. And so if it was in the West, she'd be locked away. But the Buddha actually just talked to her and became an arahat, fully enlightened. So even a crazy woman can become enlightened. Okay, they said there's only some types of karma which will stop you, you can't let go of, and that's when you kill your mother or kill your father. There's a few other things, but those are the main ones. They call it so the antarayaka karma. So if in this life you've killed your mother or you've killed your father, the other ones are if you've raped a bhikkhuni, if you've shed the blood of a Buddha, created a schism in a sangha. See? Are getting an arahat as well. And what's the other one? That's it, isn't it?
That's it.
Yeah, the six antarayaka karmas. That if you've done any one of those in this lifetime, you cannot become an arahat. You cannot become enlightened. Next lifetime you can, but not in this one. I mean, so the Buddha's last illness, and was that because of some karma in the past? It could have been, but even Angulimala had to receive some of the karma. It was only a small amount. So still there is some like karmic effect, but nothing which stops you becoming enlightened. You can just let go of that. You don't need to punish yourself for that. The mind state can be pure, although the body has to experience the pain of the bad karma. So it's the mental karma, it's purified. Does that make sense? Was that what you were asking? Yeah. Sangha? What? The Sangha is always referring in the suttas to the monks and nuns. The Arya Sangha, which is the enlightened stream winners, ones who turn as non-returners, arahats. Those ones who are Aryans are spread between lay people and the monks and nuns. When it's called the Arya Sangha, it means those monks and nuns who are the Aryans. It's a subset of the monastic Sangha. But the Aryans, those who have the four stages of enlightenment, they can be anything, monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen. Is that what you're asking? Do you need to become a monk to be enlightened? That question, okay. No, that's not what you're asking. Do you want to know anyway? Okay. Need to become a monk or nun to become enlightened? Become a stream winner, the first stage of enlightenment, monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen, all the same. But once you become a stream winner, this is it's not as if that you just become a stream winner and you're just the same as you were before. There's consequences. There's some natural things which happen afterwards, such as like your faith increases enormously and your understanding about the Dhamma, and your ability even to let go increases enormously because you know what non-self means. Number two, when you become a once returner, you know, your desires, sensory pleasures, lust, and your ill will just get so reduced. You're just not an angry, lustful, desiring person anymore. And when you become an anagami, whether you're a monk, nun, layman, laywomen, all of that lust and sensual desire disappear completely. And there's some good examples of laymen, laywomen who were anagamis, non-returners, and it gives descriptions of, you know, their lifestyle. Number one, they're celibate, they just can't have sex. It's not because it's against the rules. It becomes impossible for them to have sex physically because the mind hasn't got that lust anymore. It just can't do it. Now, there's one case of this lady who was a woman disciple who was an anagami, and she said that her son was arrested by some soldiers because they got the wrong person and executed in front of her. And she said it was amazing that because, as an anagami, her attachment to her, even her son, was completely eradicated. She felt no change of heart when she was watched over it with complete equanimity when her son was being executed for something he never did. And that actually shows you what the attainment of anagami is, how much you can let go. It's not my son, it's just some karma, whatever happened. You can't do anything about it, you let go. And the other one was this Gatikara, who was a potter. He was an anagami. So he would never even dig the earth to get his clay because he thought he might kill some living beings in the earth. He just actually waited for the rats to dig their holes and use that for his clay, or when there was any clay left over from when the farmers made their dikes in the paddy fields, he would use that. And he would never sell anything. He would just make his pots, put them on a bench outside his house, and with a sign saying, anyone wants a pot, please take one, no charge. Anyone who wants to leave some rice and lentils, please leave some. So it's like a barter, but, you know, barter without any, if you want to take a pot, just take it. If you want to leave something, leave it. And that's how he fed himself and his two blind parents. The only reason he didn't become a monk, his mother and father were blind and could not look after themselves. So that's the sort of thing an anagami is by nature. Celibates, just completely unattached to their family. They look after them, but, you know, without any attachment there, and not into money or possessions. And they also, the other characteristic of the anagami, always the same, they have no trouble getting the four jhanas easy because they've got no impediments to those at all. And those are the anagamis. So you can even tell who's an anagami, who's not an anagami, just by their lifestyle, whether they're really attached to things, interested in money, whether they cry or get upset when one of their relations dies or gets into trouble. This is someone who've left that world. They've just only got a tiny bit of attachment left. And the attachment of the anagamis is the attachment to the mental states of jhanas. Yeah, you can get attached to the jhanas, but if you do, it's just the difference between being an anagami and an arahat. And the arahat is when you've let go of those attachments as well. Lay people can become arahats too. You can become an arahat, but there's a consequence to that. And the consequence is that you have to join the Sangha. You have to. You've got no choice, otherwise you just die.
In spirit or in actuality?
In actuality. Otherwise there's no purpose. You just don't fit anymore. You're a square peg in a round hole. That's right, yeah. Otherwise, just your will to live just disappears. Remember, to live, it's not just having a healthy body. It's also the will to live. And that will is a very, very strong thing. And with the attainment of, already, like, you know, some of you have gone into deep meditation, see the attenuation of the will. And if it's in the second jhana, there's no will left at all. Potential to do is gone. Temporarily, but it's gone. And sometimes that gives you an intuition, an inference about what it would be like to be an arahat. There'd be no reason to carry on. literally, unless you can, you know, join as the Sangha and do something for Buddhism that way. Otherwise, you just poof, go. Sorry? Anagamis don't get angry, neither do arahats. And that's always been the way you test out if someone's an anagami or an arahat. If your husband comes home and says, I'm an anagami, you just really tease him, push his buttons, and try and make him angry. What, you stupid camel-faced husband? You can't become enlightened. Not you. And if he gets angry, you know, yeah, he wasn't. Well, I don't know what it is. It might be even less than that, but he's certainly not an anagami or an arahat. That's always been the way, the tradition. In Buddhism, when someone comes along to you and they say they're an anagami or an arahat, you do your best to actually to put them down, to tease them, to be offensive to them, to say something, anything to try and get them angry. So you're testing their attainment. Yeah. No. Enlightenment, yeah. No, that's afterwards. So you can become a stream winner, once returner, non-returner, an arahat. If you become an arahat, it's just nature. This is what you have to do. Just like, it's not, you know, okay, now I'm an arahat, what are the rules? This is not sort of something you concoct. This is a nature of things. So it's a nature of things that when you become a stream winner, you have incredible faith. When you become a non-returner, your lust, your anger disappears. It's not to say, oh, I'm an anagami now, a non-returner, I can't get angry, I'm not allowed to get angry anymore. It's not something you concoct or play with, it's your nature. And when you become an arahat, if you become an arahat here, then you just come and ask me and say, oh, just can I become a nun or can I join the Sangha? There's no other point anymore. It's a natural flowing. It's not rules which somebody lays down. This is like laws of nature, like laws of physics. Does that understand? Like, for example, you know, when you give birth to a baby, certain things happen to your body. You don't choose that these things happen. This is what happens. It's nature. When you give birth to the Dhamma, these things happen. It's nature. When you become old, other things happen to your body. It's nature. You can't stop it. When you become sort of anagami, you lose certain things. It's nature. Just you don't fit anywhere else, so you say, okay, basically I am a monk or a nun. There's nothing else I agree with in the world. There's nothing holding. There's nothing really meaningful in the world anymore. Oh no. After. Yeah. So, but I warn you, this is what happens. So you've already been warned, don't come out and say, ah, Jabba, you never told me this. You know, becoming an arahat, now I have to go and join the Sangha, or become an anagami, I can't have lust, I can't enjoy my TV anymore. This is what happens, you're just not interested in those things. Because these attainments, this is what happens, you've let go of attachments, let go of cravings, it disappeared. And this is what it looks like. So it's where they belong. You just can't do it anymore. Sure, yeah, it has happened. So they just want to become a monk or a nun. Basically, they are a monk or a nun inside. Just that's who they are. That's what they become. It's like a person, say, has a sex change from a man to a woman. And then they just want to wear dresses. They want to go. They belong in the women's toilets. They don't go to the men's toilets anymore. That's just where they go. So just, no, I'm trying to get similes. It's very hard to get similes. And that's where you can look. On their own. Yeah, sure. They can be on their own, but they're basically living as a monk or a nun. If there is a monastery around, they just go and join it. There's no point to going to work in it. Money's got no point anymore to it. It's useless. Yeah. Yeah.
Either positive or negative, but it also has hell realms.
Yeah.
Why does it have hell realms and karma?
Why do you have hell realms? It's because you choose to go to hell. You want to go to hell, and you make your hell realms. There are many descriptions of hell realms in the suttas. They're actually all made by you. And if you've got a very active mind, you'll make an original hell realm which never has been existed before, just for yourself. The reason is, what actually happens, with the hell realms, is again, it's all because of guilt, because people will not forgive themselves. So you see this, you know, in human nature, they've done some bad thing, and they want to pay for it. And the worse the crime, the more they want to actually to punish themselves. And they create the punishment. Because these hell realms are mind-made realms. They're not sort of physical realms, mind-made realms. So, but for you, it's just as it is actually happening. You create those realms.
So, is that one of the reasons why Buddhists want to be totally accepting of karma and the moment of death?
Yeah, because otherwise you can actually, if you start thinking of all the terrible things you've done in the past, you develop the fault-finding mind, you look at the two bad bricks in your life, and you focus on those. Then you'd send yourself to hell. Yeah, someone else asked a question from over there somewhere.
I couldn't hear.
The fascinating thing, I gave a talk some time ago about creation. Who is the creator? You are. You create the hell realms and the heaven realms and this realm as well. You create your happiness and your sadness. You can forgive yourself at any time. But why don't we? You are the creator. So don't blame anybody else. When we understand about forgiveness, this is why a stream winner, one who's seen the Dhamma, will never go to the lower realms again. We mentioned that they're not subject to the lower realms. They cannot go to hell anymore. And I often wonder, why? And it's because they don't need to. They've forgiven themselves. They know enough about non-self to realize they can detach, they can untie themselves from their past deeds. Our self is made up of our past. And we sort of concoct this self, we make it up. And it's made a lot of time from our past bad deeds. And because of that, we have to be punished for those past deeds, because they're part of ourself. When we can let go of those part deeds, it's like letting go of a lot of ourself. Only a stream winner knows how to do that. So therefore you'll never go to those bad realms again. You can forgive yourself. You can walk out of jail.
But forgiving yourself does not allow karma to go.
It doesn't allow the whole of karma to go, but the karma of the hell realms disappears.
Is that the dilution thing which you're talking about?
It's not any dilution, it's complete letting go.
No, but
yeah. No, actually the forgiveness actually just abandons it. That's why I even got a word for it called ahosi karma. Karma that is no more.
What's the karma of putting bad things about and open beings?
Aha. Have you got crows in your hometown? Who make this terrible sound, ga 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 ga. That's when you've used bad speech. And you sound like a bad person, you make a bad sound afterwards. I don't know if that's true, but that's what somebody said a long time ago. Crows because crows just make the most awful sound. And they say that's because they said bad things about others in a previous life. I don't know if it's true, but maybe. But if you say bad things about, you know, other enlightened beings, if you ask forgiveness or give yourself forgiveness, there's no problem. Well, it doesn't matter who you say bad things to. I mean, it's always bad karma. But sometimes it's even worse karma. It's just like if you have a road accident, and it's just, you know, say your son, it doesn't really, you know, you can probably fix it up. But if it's like a police car you run into, you're in big trouble. So abusing a monk, teasing a monk. Well, if it's someone like Ajahn Brahm, you don't have to worry about it, because I teach you back. I give as good as I get, and I get as good as I give. But no, it's the most compassionate people will forgive you. It's only teasing. It's no malice in there at all. If it's malicious, now you really want to sort of upset someone or cause some pain or suffering, then that's bad karma. Oh yeah, but okay. Is the intention ameliorated because it's from the teacher's instructions? If you go to a court of law because you've killed your husband, and you said because Ajahn Brahm told you to kill your husband, you still go to jail. That wouldn't ameliorate it at all. You still did it. It was your intention to kill. And your motivation may have been for some other reason, but it's still, this is a bad thing to do. So it's still bad karma. So say, some people say that, you know, they hear these voices telling them to kill this person or kill that person. It still doesn't ameliorate the bad karma. I see what you're meaning, because slightly different, but still bad. Bad enough. Yeah. Still bad enough. Just blaming someone else. He made me do it, or she made me do it, or he deserved it, or she deserved it. They were asking for it anyway. Look what they were doing. You're still killing. Soldiers as well, yeah. And if I know some soldiers, and of course when they do kill in war, they still feel that karma terribly. Build karma. No, because karma is intention and buildings don't have intentions. But sometimes there's beings in that building, beings attached to that building. Something may have happened there, someone got killed or suicide or something. And so that energy is still around there. So I mentioned that when we came here, I think last time, what was the time before? We landed in Kathmandu, we were taken to the old city, and there was one place in there, the old palace. I went through a door when shouldn't have done. I was just wandering out to see what was there. A terrible feeling inside. I just wanted to run out as soon as possible. When I asked why, there was this post in the ground. That's where they do this sacrifice every year for the king's and the country's well-being. It's a Hindu festival of sacrifice. They still do that. They get animals and they slaughter them. Group karma. Sometimes all karma is individual. We do it ourselves, but sometimes we do things together. So we've all come on pilgrimage together. So in that sense, we've all done our karma individually, but we've also done it together. So we've all done group good karma. So, you know, if you get reborn, we probably get reborn in good places together. It's the same if you're like a group of soldiers and you go massacre a village together, like the US Army did in My Lai in the Vietnam War. They did it together, and so a lot of them will receive the results together. It's individual, basically, but you can say it's group karma as well. If they do things together, for example, they go to church together, or they do a collection for the tsunami together, or they go and make an orphanage together. Yeah, they're doing it together, doing good together. So that's why I think sometimes they do bad together, like all these suicide cults kill themselves together. This is not a suicide cult. Yeah, one last question and then we'll stop because it's getting late. Yeah. I think the vested interest, they just want to be something. It's a sense of self. It's all tied up with the illusion of a self, of a me. Where there's a self, there's things which belong to a self. It's actually what you said, the answer when you were asking it. This is what you cling on to, what you attach on to. We're attached to our past, the good and bad. And to let go of the bad, we have to let go of the good as well. We have to let go of ourselves. So it's the whole point of like the self idea. And because we hold on to a self, that's why we have to punish ourselves. If we can actually see what this illusion is and understand the Buddha's teaching on non-self, at that point, and you see that as the stream winner, at that time you can let go of the bad. It's obvious, you don't have to hold on to it anymore. The fetter, the attachment is broken. So it's as if, you know, this big barge or this big trailer of bad karma you've been lugging around all the time, and yet you untie it, unbolt the chain, and you walk on without that bad karma anymore. You're attached to it because it's my bad karma. I did it. It's mine. No one else's. Leave it alone. I don't want to let it go. It's mine. It's me. It's part of me. It's who I am. That's what happens. So it's easy to say, but you can't do it unless you see non-self. It's too much of an intrinsic attachment. You're bound up with your karma. So that's why stream winners, they let go of a lot of the past. Bad karma. It also means the stream winner, it's easy to meditate. Because you can easily let go of the past, it doesn't matter what's happened. And if you go a non-returner, you let go of so much of the past, jhanas are a doddle. That's what happens. And this is nature, not rules, it's just the natural flowering of a human being. Okay, so that's enough. An interesting Q&A tonight. So those who are still got some energy, we can sit some meditation. Those who are tired and sleepy can go and do some what I call meditating flat out. So you can lay flat out on your nice beds and meditate flat out. And we'll see you in the morning, 5 o'clock wake up call, get your bags out, usual way of doing it, outside the door, take them down yourself if you want to help people by 6 o'clock. So they get put on the bus. 6 o'clock is breakfast, so get your bags out so you're all packed up before breakfast. 6 o'clock breakfast, and 7 o'clock. We move south to Benares, the oldest city, probably one of the oldest cities in the world. It was an old city even by the time when the Buddha was around. He called it an old city. It's one of the oldest ancient cities in the world. We're going there tomorrow. So get a good night's sleep and see you tomorrow on the bus to Benares. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. What is it anyway? Okay. Just a minute. Okay. 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 For those of you who are going to be meditating, we'll ring the bell after half an hour, just once or twice. So if you want to do a half an hour sit, there'll be a bell after 30 minutes.
Those of you who are in jhanas, you won't hear it anyway. Those of you who have fallen asleep, you won't hear it anyway. Those of you in between sleep and jhanas, it will just remind you half an hour has gone past. You don't have to get up. If you want to get up, you can go to bed, or you can carry on sitting.